From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet gay rights activist Candace Gingrich, Newt Gingrich's sister. She's the spokesperson for the National Coming Out Project of the Human Rights Campaign Fund, the nation's largest gay rights group. We'll ask if she thinks coming out has affected her brother's position on gay rights. Also, we talk with William Murray, son of the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare. When he was in the eighth grade, he was the plaintiff in the Supreme Court decision that outlawed school prayer. Now he's a Christian, working to get prayer back into the schools. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. An explosion blew through a Paris commuter train today, killing 4 people. At least 60 people have been hurt. French Prime Minister Alain Juppé says authorities suspect a bomb went off in the crowded rush hour train. No cause of the blast has yet been confirmed. Witnesses told French television they could smell gunpowder after the blast. The explosion occurred on a regional train line that is not part of the city subway system. Anti-terrorism investigators are on the scene. An attorney for slain cult leader David Koresh told a congressional panel today that the 1993 siege of the Davidian compound in Waco did not have to end in violence. Dick DeGaren said the FBI refused to consider a peaceful resolution. We have more from NPR's Frank Stacio.
DeGaren told the House subcommittee that Koresh had agreed to give himself up once he finished writing his interpretation of a section of the Bible. He said that the final tragedy could have been avoided had federal authorities not resorted to the tank and tear gas assault. But Democrats on the panel pointed out that Koresh had not lived up to previous promises to surrender. The tank assault in April of 1993 ended a 51-day siege following a failed raid on the compound that resulted in the deaths of 4 federal officers and 6 Davidians. In that shootout, DeGaren said the Davidians told him that agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms fired first, and said that his own observation after the ATF raid confirmed their testimony. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Top Bosnian Serb leaders have been indicted for war crimes. The Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal has indicted Serbian leader Radovan Karadzic and Bosnian Serb army leader Ratko Mladic for crimes against humanity. These charges include genocide. One leader of the Croatian Serbs has also been indicted. The New Jersey State Supreme Court has upheld Megan's Law, which requires police to notify residents when a convicted sex offender moves into their community. NPR's Melissa Block reports.
Megan's Law was signed last October and was challenged by a convicted sex offender known as John Doe. In its ruling, the Supreme Court upheld the law with some limited modifications, saying it does not constitute cruel and unusual punishment or double jeopardy. Nor, the court said, does it deprive sex offenders of their constitutional right to privacy. An earlier ruling by a federal judge declaring Megan's Law unconstitutional is under appeal. Since the law was put into effect in New Jersey, there have been cases of vigilantism against sex offenders once their identity became known. In at least one case, the vigilante attack was against the wrong man. Megan's Law is named for 7-year-old Megan Kanka, who was raped and murdered allegedly by a convicted sex offender who lived across the street. New York's Governor George Pataki is signing a similar bill today. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 42 points. It's 4,710 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is up almost 15 at 993. This is NPR. The Justice Department has opened 2 criminal probes of the tobacco industry. They're trying to find out whether tobacco industry executives lied to Congress and federal regulators about smoking and the addictiveness of nicotine. The U.S. attorney in New York has begun a grand jury investigation into whether Philip Morris Company hid findings from its nicotine studies from federal regulators. Philip Morris is the world's biggest tobacco company. The Justice Department's criminal division in Washington will soon call tobacco executives before a grand jury. They want to look into whether tobacco executives perjured themselves before Congress in hearings more than a year ago. The main air traffic control computer for much of the Midwest is back online. Investigators are still trying to pinpoint the cause of yesterday's outage. From member station WBEZ, Tony Sarabia reports.
Things are starting to get back to normal at the air traffic control center outside Chicago, where controllers had to use backup computers after the 5th computer outage in 10 months. Technicians brought the main computer back up early this morning. The most recent outage began yesterday. A Federal Air Administration official says safety was never compromised.
Even from the onset of this yesterday afternoon, we immediately went to the backup system. It's a safe system. It was designed to do exactly what it does, back up the primary system.
The FAA says the computers are old and prone to failure, but adds there's not much they can do about it until the new ones arrive sometime in 1998. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Sarabia in Chicago.
The Labor Department says American workers are still seeing rather slow growth in their compensation. The agency says wages, salaries, and benefits rose 2.9% in the year ended June 30th. The advance matches the gain reported at the end of the first quarter of this year. That was the smallest rise since the Labor Department began tracking this in 1981. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. While Newt Gingrich is leading the Republican Revolution, his sister Candace is urging gays and lesbians to come out of the closet and send a message to Congress that it's time to end discrimination against gays. Candace Gingrich is on a 51-city tour in her capacity as the spokesperson for the National Coming Out Project of the Human Rights Campaign Fund, the largest gay rights group in the U.S. Before she became a gay rights activist last November, she worked as a computer consultant and sorted packages at UPS. Candace is much younger than Newt. He was already married and a father when Candace was born in 1966. Newt has a different birth father, but Candace's father adopted Newt when Newt was 7. By the way, Candace pronounces her last name Gingrich. She says Newt changed the pronunciation after moving to Georgia, where everyone else pronounced it Gingrich. I spoke with Candace Gingrich this morning and asked if it was a difficult decision to become a gay rights activist while her brother was Speaker of the House.
It wasn't difficult at all. I had been waiting pretty much for the opportunity to finally get out there and do something for a very long time. Prior to last November, I kind of had, I call it my self-imposed don't ask, don't tell policy, that it would probably really upset and tick my family off if I were to go public, you know, i.e. call a press conference or, you know, have an interview, an exclusive somewhere, and you know, become, have it become nationally known that I was a lesbian. But I felt, and I'm not sure, I haven't talked to them to see if it made a difference or not, but I felt that if someone were to come to me and ask me, someone from the press, from the media, that that would be different. So I couldn't have been happier when I was asked if I was gay last fall.
Who asked you?
It was a woman from the Associated Press who had come up to do some background information on Newt and saw a photo of me from college, and I have a crew cut, and I guess she made some presumptions, and after interviewing me, asked the question.
And you said?
I said, yes, I am.
And what changed after that?
Well, nothing really started changing. You know, I had a couple people call for interviews here and there. The biggest thing that changed that happened was that people from the Human Rights Campaign Fund called me up and asked, and we had lunch, and it was actually the executive director, the new executive director, and the communications director who talked with me. And I told them what I was concerned with, you know, what happened in November and why it, you know, why the change in the House and the Senate concerned me, frightened me, scared me, all the other adjectives. They asked if I would be interested in being the spokesperson for the project, for the National Coming Out Project. And I was just delighted and honored that they would, you know, think that I was worthy of that just from my few public appearances or whatever. So
did you consult your family first, your parents?
No.
Or your brother?
No. No, it's nothing actually I've ever really done. I was 28 at the time, and it was pretty much good on making my own life decisions. Life decisions anyhow, not like where to eat or anything like that. I'm bad at that. But
so what was your brother Newt's reaction when you officially became a gay activist?
I really have no idea. I mean, as far as his personal reaction, we've heard, I believe from his press secretary, that he was pleased as punch, and these are his press secretary's words, that I was joining the Human Rights Campaign Fund. So that's what his public opinion was, and I don't know what
Did you take that at face value, or did you take that as an ironic statement? A sarcastic statement?
Well, maybe not sarcastic, maybe just a little hint of condescension. But still, it was, you know, it was nice.
When did your brother Newt first find out that you were gay?
That was back when the family found out, which was in, would have been like the summer of 87, when my mother and I had, you know, our first talk, and then she pretty much went and told everyone else in the family. I didn't do it. I let her talk to them.
Why did you want her to do it?
Well, I didn't even want her to do it. She just did it, and it was. I figured they would find out eventually. It wasn't anything that I felt a need to, like, tell everyone, because I knew she would tell them anyhow.
I think a lot of people who think of themselves as being opposed to homosexuality and gay rights, when they actually know somebody who's gay, they don't necessarily dislike that person because of their homosexuality. And I it's really the position of your group that it's harder mm-hmm. to be anti-gay once you know someone who is gay. What effect did you think, or if you thought about this, that your homosexuality would have on your brother Newt Gingrich?
I have no idea. You know, it obviously hasn't had any. It may in his private life, but so far as, you know, as a politician, as the leader of the so-called Republican Revolution, he's, you know, continued the anti-gay rhetoric that has been so popular in the party in the past, so.
Your brother Newt is 23 years older than you. Mm-hmm. That's a big difference. And your father is his stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ever close?
We never even lived in the same house together. I don't think the word close is appropriate. For the most part, we've seen each other a couple times a year.
What are family gatherings?
Family
holidays?
Gatherings. When I was younger, there were a few times that we went down to Georgia and spent with he and his daughters, going to Six Flags, doing that kind of stuff. A few times that we've gone down to the district and done the usual Washington sightseeing things. But I don't think close can apply to, you know, a relationship like that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Candace Gingrich, and she's spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign Fund's National Coming Out Project. She's the half-sister of Newt Gingrich. Let me back up a little bit in your story. When did you realize that you were a lesbian?
Well, I didn't actually acknowledge it until I was in college, until I was about 20. I had certainly had feelings prior to that. As early as, you know, going to Girl Scout camp and finding one of my camp goers to be attractive, and I remember thinking to myself that was an interesting feeling to be having, but never really thinking about it any further than that. Because once you leave Girl Scout camp, you never see that person again, basically. But I felt different. But it was never in a bad sense. I always considered myself different in a special way. That there was something that I wasn't quite getting, and that lasted, you know, all the way until, I guess it was my third year in college, when I became friends with a group of women who were out and were open and very, you know, happy and proud and comfortable with who they were. And it kind of took being in that situation, that setting, for me to say, you know, this feels right. This is okay. I'm not the only one. And this is that information, or that understanding that I've been on the verge of, you know, for the past, you know, like 10 years of my life.
I think for a lot of people, when they're in that kind of in-between period, when they think maybe they're gay and they're not really sure, that they're particularly impressionable about, you know, signals that they're picking up from the larger culture about what it means to be gay.
Yeah.
Now, your brother is one of those people in that larger culture who is putting out signals about what gay is, and the signal was it's not very good. Did that have an impact on you when you were trying to figure out your sense of yourself?
Actually, at that time in my life, I was paying absolutely no attention to what Newt was doing, socially, economically, anything with his career. I was in college myself. There were a lot of other things. I became numb to it because, you know, I talk about this often. My mother's very, very proud of him, and she talks about him incessantly. Well, not incessantly, a lot. And although some people have attributed it to jealousy, I just, you know, personally got tired of it. And as a reaction to that, didn't pay attention at all to what he was doing. So actually, I think more than anything, there are two things that influenced my not understanding soon enough. Well, three, okay. One was not having anyone that I thought I could talk to about it, whether it be a school counselor or anyone in my family. I just really didn't feel like there was anyone who would understand. Two, being an athlete, one of the only really negative memories or images that I have is that the homophobia that exists in women's athletics, and how overly fearful that some of the people on the teams that I played on, the girls were, you know, that they would be perceived as lesbian. And so that definitely wasn't a positive thing. And just the other one being that the people that I knew that were lesbians prior to the ones that I met in college were already, they had jobs, they were already established, and they weren't out because, you know, you can be fired for being gay or lesbian. And that was a fear that they had. So they weren't actually comfortable with who they were. So it took that you know, that college atmosphere and those people being in it who were free for me to realize that it was okay.
So how did your parents find out that you were gay?
Well, my mother found the Lavender Letter, which is a Central PA lesbian newsletter, in my room, and brought it to me and showed it to me, and, you know, wanted to know if I was trying to tell her something.
Were you?
I didn't leave it out. It wasn't like I left it on my bed. It was like stuffed away. You know.
Was she going through your stuff?
Pretty much so. That's not that she was like, you know, rifling through my belongings, but, you know, mom snoop. Most of them do, that they all do that. So, I don't remember consciously doing it or even caring if she found out or not, but she did and brought it to me, and, you know, and we had a discussion about it, and pretty much she's, you know, the victim of society and the stereotypes that prevail about gay and lesbian people.
So what was that discussion like?
Well, it was basically just her not understanding, you know, how could this happen? Well, mom, it's, you know, there's nothing we could do. You know, this is the way I am. I've had these feelings for a very long time. Well, whatever happened to you? Well, nothing happened to me, mom. This is who I am. What did your father and I do wrong? You didn't do anything wrong. This is a good thing. This is fine. I'm glad we're having this conversation. And the inevitable. Well, are you sure that you just haven't met the right man yet? And it's, for me, I thought it was very, you know, I tried to help her understand. And, you know, I thought that it was, you know, not that she did understand explicitly, but at least I knew that she accepted me, you know, and it didn't change the way that she felt about me.
Did she accept it in the sense of tolerating it, or did she actually turn a corner and become supportive of you?
I guess probably if I have to pick one of those two choices, she probably just was tolerant of that aspect of my life. I kind of hate using that word because it's become so, you know, considering the comments that Newt has made about tolerance, it isn't exactly the best word to use. But, you know, one of the things I told her back then was that, you know, well, at least you don't have to pay for a wedding. Mom, and she said since then many times that she would rather pay for the wedding. So, yeah, she can still pay for a wedding. I'll just be marrying a woman. That's all. Okay, I'll tell her that. She'll be happy.
I wonder if, I don't know if you know this or not, but, you know, if your mother feels like she has divided loyalty now on the issue of gay rights, because, you know, on the one hand, her son Newt is not exactly out campaigning for gay rights, and on the other hand, her daughter is gay and is campaigning for gay rights. So does she take sides?
I haven't actually ever discussed it with her. I haven't sat down, you know, and said, you know, Mom, do you realize that I'm right and he's wrong? I haven't brought that up yet. I think that even if she would have feelings like that, I'm not sure that she would share them with me because she wouldn't want to be, you know, on one side versus the other side. I think that, you know, she probably tries her best just to be a mom and to love us both in whatever endeavors that we're involved in.
Candace Gingrich is my guest, and she is the sister of Newt Gingrich. They pronounce their names differently. She's spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign Fund's National Coming Out Project. Candace Gingrich came out as a lesbian, what, about close to a year ago? Came out publicly.
We'll say nationally. Well, okay, yeah, publicly. About a year ago. Well, no, it wasn't even a year. 6 months. November, whenever that was.
Okay. Well, let's take a short break.
Sure.
And then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Candace Gingrich. She is Newt Gingrich's sister and spokesperson for the Human Rights Campaign Fund's National Coming Out Project. Is there any message that you think your brother should take away from the fact that his sister is a lesbian?
Well, I mean, he actually, when we met in March, one of the things that he said, he was questioned by a reporter about family values. You know, he and I are, and my other sister, Rob, are sitting out, you know, on the balcony. And a reporter said, you know, Mr. Gingrich, last fall you campaigned on a platform to return to traditional family values. How can you justify having a sister who's a lesbian? And Newt said a really great thing. He said, well, this is the American family in all of its complexities. And I think that is a message that he, as well as the rest of the country, can really learn a lot from. For a very long time, we've been kind of an invisible population, and the prevailing myth has been, you know, we, you know, live under rocks and come from bad, dysfunctional, you know, whatever kind of families. And, you know, I think this shows a lot of people and should show him that we have worth, we have value, and we deserve, you know, to have the same rights that other people do, that non-gay people enjoy. And so that's, you know, that would be a good message that he can take away from it.
I imagine that now you've been carefully following your brother's statements that have to do with homosexuality. What are some of the things that he's said that you think are most damaging to the cause of gay rights?
That would imply that there are things that have been good. Well, I mean, some of the things are particularly damaging. I remember how I felt. Actually, it was Thanksgiving dinner, last Thanksgiving. He wasn't there. It was my two sisters, their families, my mom and my dad. And one of them asked me what I thought about Newt's comment about tolerating homosexuality. And I said, you know, what are you talking about? And they told me the quote that he had said that, you know, we should tolerate it much like we tolerate alcoholism. And I was just, you know, infuriated. And, you know, in one sense, you know, you could almost look at it as a small victory to hear somebody that's a staunch, ultra right-wing conservative saying that we should be tolerated, you know, as opposed to persecuted as Mr. Helms and Mr. Dornan would like us to be. But to, you know, to compare it to alcoholism, to know that his version of tolerance still allows for us to be fired for being gay or lesbian, still allows for us to be kicked out of our homes, our apartments, still allows for us to be the victims of crimes without being recognized as hate crimes. That incensed me.
Because your brother is Newt Gingrich, your coming out has a news value. What message do you think people should take away from the fact that you are who you are and your brother is who he is?
Well, I mean, one thing is people are usually very curious about how this disparity, you know, could occur in a family, that there could be people with such differing views. And I think that one of the things is that I think everyone's families have different opinions among them. Some are more stronger than others. Ours, we just happen to be polar opposites, and just everyone in the country just happens to know about that. So it seems a lot more of a big issue than it really is. But the other thing is that you know, I don't, we still respect each other. We're still proud of each other. We still love each other. And, you know, if we could get that point across to some of the radical right extremists that, you know, you don't have to, you don't have to agree, condone, approve of who we are. Just, you know, you don't need to hate us. You don't need to discriminate against us. You don't need to, you know, bash us at every possible opportunity. We're human beings, and we're deserving, you know, of respect that you reserve for other people.
You are a spokesperson now for the National Coming Out Project. How out were you at work before you really came out in the national arena?
Well, I don't. When people would ask me questions, I would answer them truthfully. You know, as far as, you know, what did you do this weekend? You know, I would say, well, you know, Linda and I went to the movies, who was my partner at the time or whatever. You know, I would say, well, we went out to the bar. I was in D.C. for the March on Washington, you know, whatever. I didn't wear, like, you know, I'm not a lesbian, but my girlfriend is T-shirts or anything. But, you know, certainly in my everyday conversations, I was open about who I was. I mean, like at UPS, there's not really much opportunity to chat with people because, you know, you're supposed to be working and moving those boxes, not talking to people. So
did you ever go through this? Did you ever go through, well, if my being gay isn't having an impact on changing my own brother, how can I expect to change anybody else's opinion?
Well, actually, no, I never thought about it that way, Tara, because I think it's more the other way around, that it's much easier for me to talk to other people and help educate them because they don't have to worry about the radical right breathing down their necks and not, you know, withholding support in the next election year or anything like that because of their opinions. You know, I think that that's maybe one of the roadblocks to his enlightenment is that, you know, he has a certain, I don't want to say image, but there are certain things that they would not appreciate, they being the radical right, for somebody who is the leader of the Republican Revolution to say. And if he were to come out publicly in favor of our being treated equally, they probably wouldn't like that very much.
So you think that fear of losing some of his power base and funding is perhaps holding him back from...
I would think that that has to be a concern of his.
Mm-hmm. So you believe in your heart of hearts that Newt Gingrich is more open to gay rights than he lets on?
Yes, I think that, as I like to say, that I put him in a Barry Goldwater category. I don't put him in a Helms Dornan category. He's in the hopeful category. My only fear is that it won't be until after he's out of office that he will be able to show support.
Do you know if there's anybody in his staff whose job is to kind of follow you around and hear what you have to say so that they could do, you know, quote, damage control if necessary?
No, I don't know that. I don't know if there is or not. That's a good question, though, Terry. I'll make sure if
you're
anyone's
look
following
it.
Me.
Right.
Yeah, I'll see if there's the same person in every city I go to or not.
Well, Candace Gingrich, thank you very much for talking with
us. Thank you, Terry. It was fun.
Candace Gingrich is the spokesperson for the National Coming Out Project of the Human Rights Campaign Fund, a gay rights group based in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, William Murray, son of the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare. When he was in junior high, he was the plaintiff in the Supreme Court decision that banned school prayer. Now he's a Christian and wants to return prayer to the schools. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. French police have confirmed a bomb did cause today's subway explosion in Paris. A police statement says the device contained several pounds of explosive. 4 people were killed and at least 60 people are hurt. There has been no claim of responsibility for the blast. Dozens of emergency vehicles are on the scene. French Prime Minister Alain Juppé went to the scene. He was joined there by President Jacques Chirac and Paris Mayor Jean Tiberi. The train line is part of a regional express network and is separate from the Paris City subway system. President Clinton attended a ceremony today on Capitol Hill marking the 30th anniversary of Medicare. He used his remarks to blast Republican plans to cut the medical help program by $270 billion over 7 years. UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
President Clinton denounced the GOP Medicare reform plan as a piggy bank for a $250 billion tax cut for the rich.
We need to be awfully careful before we buy a pig in a poke.
Surrounded by supportive congressional Democrats and older Americans fearing deep cuts in their benefits, the president said lawmakers must be committed to slowing the growth of Medicare without destroying the program. Mr. Clinton called on Republicans to join him in a commitment to genuine health care reform if they want to balance the budget and reform Medicare. Republicans accused the president of abdicating his responsibility for keeping the Medicare trust fund solvent. Carol Van Dam, the White House.
The United Nations says the safe haven of Jeppa has fallen to the Bosnian Serbs. Government troops left the town under heavy artillery bombing. The UN says a NATO airstrike against the Serbs is doubtful. A UN team is en route to the fallen city to arrange evacuation of many civilians, but the Serbs are demanding that all men of fighting age be held as potential exchanges for prisoners of war. PLO leader Yasser Arafat is headed to Paris after becoming a father for the first time at age 65. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
For much of his life, Yasser Arafat has been called the father of the Palestinians. Yesterday, he became a biological father as well, when his 32-year-old wife, Suha, gave birth to their 5-pound, 6-ounce daughter. They named her Zahwa after Arafat's mother. The announcement was low-key in Gaza, perhaps because the baby is a girl. It might also be because Gaza is under an Israeli-imposed closure after yesterday's suicide bomb attack on an Israeli bus. Arafat told reporters he feels like any father. Many Palestinians criticized Suha Arafat for choosing to give birth in the American hospital in Paris rather than in Gaza. But she said the sanitary conditions in Gaza were appalling and she was afraid to give birth there. Although Suha was born a Christian, the baby will be raised a Muslim. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, stock prices gained 46 points today to close at 4,714. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR. Peace talks between Russia and the breakaway Republic of Chechnya have hit another snag. Both sides say they're taking a few days off to reassess the situation. From Moscow, Paul Brandis reports.
Journalists in the Chechen capital of Grozny were told the talks are being suspended for technical reasons. In non-diplomatic language, that means the talks have broken down. The stumbling block between the Russians and the Chechens is how much sovereignty the breakaway region will have in the future. The Chechens are demanding full independence. The Russians are willing to grant only limited autonomy. The bottom line for Moscow, Chechnya must remain part of the Russian Federation. The Chechens reject this. The war is now in its 8th month, and a report issued Tuesday by a private think tank here estimates the cost of rebuilding Chechnya at $5 to $6 billion. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Brandis in Moscow.
A private business group says sales of existing homes rose 6.5% last month. The National Association of Realtors says the increase brings home resales to an annual rate of more than 3.75 million units. The trade group says lower mortgage rates led to the increased sales. Resales rose in every region of the country. The East was the highest. They jumped there by 9.6%. New home sales were up nearly 20% in May. The private conference board says consumer confidence rebounded sharply in July. The business group's consumer confidence index jumped in July by 5.3% to 99.9. The scale uses the year 85 and the number 100 as bases. Improved consumer confidence is critical to a strong economic recovery. That's because consumer spending makes up two-thirds of the nation's economic activity. The conference board says consumers are more confident about current economic conditions, and expectations for the next 6 months are more optimistic than they've been. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Christian Coalition's contract with the American Family is calling for a constitutional amendment that would ease restrictions on prayer in schools and other public places. My guest William Murray was the plaintiff in the 1963 Supreme Court decision that banned prayer in public schools. Murray was in junior high at the time. The lawsuit was the idea of his mother, the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare. While she remains an atheist, William Murray has been a Christian since 1980. He regrets his role in the Supreme Court decision. In fact, he's now working to bring prayer back into public schools. He explains why in his new book, Let Us Pray. I spoke with him about his involvement in the Supreme Court case and about how his mother first realized there was prayer in his Baltimore public school. Murray told me that challenging school prayer related to his mother's larger philosophy.
My mother, more than anything else, at that given time in her life, was a devout follower of collectivist philosophy, which is a polite way of saying a Marxist. And she had applied for citizenship as a result of that in the Soviet Union, which she honestly believed was a utopian nation. And in August of 1960, she took myself and my younger brother, 8 years my younger, to Paris because she felt that the American, the embassy in the United States was mishandling the thing, her citizenship application. And in Paris, she went into the embassy and reapplied for citizenship in the Soviet Union. This went on for a couple of weeks. It became apparent that their bureaucracy was even worse than ours. And they sent her back to the United States. And we arrived back in the States too late for me just to go up and start attending school again. We were in a situation where she had to take me and explain why I was late and re-register me at the junior high school. That was probably the first time that she was in a school with me since she dropped me off for kindergarten or first grade. And at the time, I was in the eighth grade. And she literally discovered the prayer and the Bible reading and the Pledge of Allegiance as she walked me to the counselor's office, to the school office, in order to re-enroll me in the school. And that really is the moment that her battle against prayer, against Bible reading, began.
What was the prayer or Bible reading in your school like?
Well, it was interesting, to say the least. The city I have to describe first was one-third Catholic, one-third Jewish, and one-third evangelical, and most of those evangelicals were minority members, African-Americans. And so the school prayer was handled in a way that nobody would be offended, or they tried to handle it in a way that nobody would be offended, by having a reading from the Old Testament from one of the books that were recognized by those of the Jewish faith, and then to have to say the Lord's Prayer. And that was basically the context of the prayer, and then that was followed by the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States. That was the morning ceremony, and it was held 5 minutes before school began, I presume, because the school authorities at the time believed that if it was held before school and if no teacher was required to participate, that then it was not actively coercing anyone to participate.
And did the students have to recite along with any part of it?
The Lord's Prayer was said. If a student didn't feel like saying that, they didn't have to. At the time, and I don't know what the Jewish community feels about this now, but at the time, the Jewish community in Baltimore did not have a problem with the Lord's Prayer, because this was a prayer that Jesus Christ was saying to the Lord God Jehovah. And it was not a prayer that was being said to Christ or to Mary or to anyone else, but it was, in fact, an adherent to the faith of the day saying that prayer.
Jews, however, do not say the Lord's Prayer.
No, they wouldn't. Of course not. I'm saying that the Jewish community in Baltimore did not protest the saying of the Lord's Prayer because, although it isn't their prayer, it was a prayer of a Jew to Jehovah God.
Did it bother you one way or another to have the Bible reading in the Lord's Prayer?
Not at the time. I was 14 years old. I was interested in amateur radio and girls and the other things that teenagers are probably interested in. I did participate in the study classes in my mother's basement, and I did know a lot of very interesting figures associated with the far left of the day. But I was not politically active. I was not religious. Active in either direction, and but it did infuriate my mother. Her children were being told to listen to or participate in prayers to a God that she not only didn't want to worship, but wanted to be in a nation where that God was not even recognized. So I think you could see her anger and her fury there.
So she took you out of school in protest. Then at the suggestion of the ACLU, she put you back in school but told you to avoid participation in school prayer so that you could force a legal confrontation.
That's right.
So when you went back to school and the kids knew that you were involved in this protest against school prayer, how did they react to it? And what about teachers?
Oh, the reaction was bad for me. Many of the people that lived in our neighborhood were Polish, East German, Hungarian, Czechoslovakian. Many of them were first-generation immigrants to the United States who had escaped either economic or religious or political persecution in East Bloc countries. And here they had a family in their midst, right in the middle of them, in this heavily ethnic Catholic neighborhood. The neighborhood was so Catholic that the archdiocese, whenever they're going to build out a new building, sent bills to everybody by their street address and said, "You're part of the new building." Is they didn't bother to check. They figured everybody was a member of the church. The reaction was violent, and I remember one of the young men who probably I had the most violent confrontations with was a Polish boy who was actually born in Poland and whose parents had smuggled him out at maybe the age of 6 or 9 months. I think I had physical confrontations with that young man for 4 years after that.
How did you feel when you won in the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court outlawed school prayer and Bible reading?
Well, at that time, I, of course, felt vindicated. I could strut down the halls of the school and say, "You see, I was right all along. You guys are a bunch of turkeys. And see, your Catholic God and your Jewish God and your Protestant God doesn't have any power at all. And we atheists, we're the ones that triumphed over all."
My guest is William Murray. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is William Murray. He was the plaintiff in the Supreme Court decision that banned school prayer. His mother is the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare. Now William Murray is a Christian and is lobbying to return prayer to the schools. He's the author of the new book, Let Us Pray. You describe your mother as someone whose life was defined by the fight against religion, and you say her actions were ostensibly issue-centered, but in my opinion, her motives were more personal and psychological. In your opinion, what were her motives?
Oh, I think her motives started probably with my birth, because my father was a married Catholic man.
Married to somebody else.
Married to somebody else, not her, to somebody else. And she was married to a father, that, a good man, a Jewish man, who was serving in the Pacific Theater. During World War II, as she had joined the WAC, she was serving in the Atlantic Theater. And she met my father in North Africa or Spain or somewhere like that. I have no idea, and I was the result of that. She believed, I think, in her heart that when they got back to the United States, he would divorce his wife, and who was childless and who could not have children, and marry her. Instead of that, he basically told her that he was a devout Catholic, that he had come from a Catholic family, that he had sinned with her, and that that he just would not and could not abandon his church or his church doctrines or his faith in order to marry her, and that that he would remain with his wife and within his faith. And I believe that the hatred and emotionalism, the emotional hatred that she had toward God and toward God's word, began somewhere in around that period of time.
At some point, you began to think of your mother as the most hated woman in America. What impact did that have on you?
Well, that was her term, not mine. She actually dreamed up that most hated woman in America definition for herself in a Playboy magazine interview some 20 years or 30 years ago. I don't know exactly what it was. It wasn't my terminology, but it did affect my a lot of what I did from maybe age 18 to age 25 or 30. I just did not identify myself with her. I never brought it up in front of people. I just went my own way. I was involved in the airline industry. I was an airline manager. And unless somebody asked whether or not that was my mother, I just never brought it up.
You parted ways with your mother in 1977. Why was that year the turning point for you?
Well, actually, we had actually parted company earlier than that in a lot of ways. But it was actually 1976 and 1977, she had asked me to come to Austin, Texas, and assist her because her husband at the time was dying, and asked me to help her revamp, reorganize her business. And I got back after 10-year absence or 11, 12-year absence from my mother and from that environment, and I soon discovered that I had been a part of just a huge dysfunctional system, that it wasn't only politics was not the problem, and religion that may not have been the problem, but that there was a dysfunctional system there that I was a part of.
And in your family?
In the family, and I no longer fit in that dysfunctional system.
So, William Murray, in 1963, you were the plaintiff in the Supreme Court decision that took school prayer, that took prayer and Bible readings out of the school. But in 1980, you were born again. Is that the correct way to put it? Or you've
born
for the first
again,
time? I don't know.
Accepted Christ. Let me backtrack and just a little bit and mm-hmm. say that in 1977, when I walked out of my mother's home, probably for the last time, or business environment, that I left that very, very emotionally wounded and hurt. And the 2 years that I was there, I had gone from being a heavy drinker to becoming an out-and-out alcoholic. I was probably drinking a fifth of booze a day in order to escape the reality of that situation that I had found myself in down there. A lot of Christians in particular, have the wrong view of me. They see me as kind of this Saul of Tarsus figure that was charging down the road to persecute Christians, and all of a sudden God hit him with this iron hand and knocked him onto the right path. And that couldn't be further from the truth. I was an emotionally distraught and destroyed individual who came out of a dysfunctional family as an alcoholic that sought help in a 12-step program and discovered God there, and then had to go look for his name because that 12-step program does not have the name of God.
My guest is William Murray, son of the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare. William Murray is now a Christian. We'll talk more in a minute. This is Fresh Air. UN officials are confirming that the Muslim safe haven Jeppa has fallen to the Serbs. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We have quite a few stories from Bosnia tonight, Terry. In addition to covering the fall of Jeppa, we have the United Nations has declared Bosnian Serb leaders to be war criminals for the acts that they have committed against the Muslim refugees. We are covering a battle in the West for Bihać, and we have a profile of the life of a United Nations soldier. We also have a commentary from Dan Shore. We're looking also at several updates. The Susan Smith trial, her husband testified today, the Whitewater hearings, and this is the 30th anniversary of Medicare.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is William Murray. He was the plaintiff in the Supreme Court decision that banned school prayer. His mother is the famous atheist Madeline Murray O'Hare. Now, William Murray is a Christian and is lobbying to return prayer to the schools. He's the author of the new book, Let Us Pray. So I'd like you to look back now and give us your critique of the decision that you helped happen, the 1963 Supreme Court decision that ruled out school prayer and Bible readings.
Well, there are a couple of aspects. Number one, what was going on in that school at that time was clearly unconstitutional it was state mandated. The prayers were being chosen by the state. The book, prayer book, or Bible to read from was picked by the state. And the government was not being what I believe our founding fathers wanted to be, which was to have benevolent neutrality toward religion. And so as far as what happened right there and then, as that specific practice that was going on, was probably wrong and should have been corrected locally at some point, given the ethnic backgrounds of the area. What that Supreme Court decision has become over the last 30 years is an entirely other thing. That Supreme Court decision has been used where it now is used, and it's an instrument of repression of freedom of speech, of freedom of assembly, of freedom of press. When there was prayer in the schools in 1961 or 62 or 63, nobody stopped me from saying publicly that I was an atheist. Nobody stopped me from bringing atheist material from school. Nobody stopped me during the lunch hour from making atheistic comments. However, today, Christians are told if they are being too Christian, or Jewish students are told if they are acting inappropriately, or if they're bowing their head to pray over lunch, or they're being told that they can't mention God or mention their religion during a valedictorian speech or during a campaign for an office. They're being told that they cannot write reports on certain subjects or on certain books because those are religious.
I think the examples that you're giving probably are examples that vary from school to school and from state to state, depending on the interpretation within that region and within that specific school. I'm wondering if how you would like to see the law rewritten, what kind of prayer you would feel most comfortable having in the school now.
Well, first and foremost, I believe that that should be a matter of local issue. When prayer was removed from the schools in 1963, there were 17 states that had no prayer in the schools at all. They didn't want it. They had other ethnic considerations, they just did not have it. I think that it should be up to the local school board. I think that if the local school board does permit it, then it should be something that is originated by the students and that is student-led, and that the only government interference should be to make sure that no single denomination or religion is dominating the issue, that there should be benevolent neutrality on the part of the government.
Now, I was reading a Los Angeles Times article from 1989 that said that your mother, Madeline Murray O'Hare, had gone to the Moscow International Book Fair and set up an atheist booth, and nobody came to the booth, but on either side of her there were big crowds at the Jewish and Christian literature booths. Were you there at that convention?
Yes, I was, and actually I went by her booth, but she had fallen asleep.
Were you selling Bibles at that fair?
They were giving them away. They were giving the Bibles away. The lines went outside the building and around the block, and there wasn't a single person in line for my mom's atheist book thing. But there was a hunger there, and I don't say that critically of her. The people had enough of official state atheism.
Do you pray for your mother?
Oh, yes. Not only do I pray for my mother, but whenever I'm at speaking engagements that are appropriate to do so, I ask the congregations, if at churches, if they would add her to their prayer lists. I think it is just highly unfortunate that. I'm sure she thinks she has lived a wonderful life, I think that it just really hasn't had any joy, real happiness, meaningful happiness in it. And there has been so much conflict that I ask congregations to pray with me that she can find some peace, that she can find a knowledge of God, that she can find a true joy. In her life, and that she can accept other people for what they are.
William Murray, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
William Murray is the author of Let Us Pray, A Plea for Prayer in Our Schools. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.